Sir.
Mr. Harrison, have you received a letter from the regional director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service about the Seward Otter Center?
We received a letter requesting the Otter Center. We did reply to the letter and agree to build the Otter Center. Yes, sir.
And I haven't seen this letter, but I've heard about it, and it was suggested that there was some dissatisfaction by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service concerning Exxon's response for this Seward Otter Center. Was that a fair characterization?
We did not ever receive a response. We responded, and we have received no response, written or verbal, to my knowledge, about that.
Well, it's certainly a little different scenario than we had described to us. In fact, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service told us that an otter rehab center was needed in Seward, that it was requested from your company in early April, that 2 weeks ago your company signed off on a land lease, that you're now in the process of signing off on modular trailers, and that because this has taken so long and there are so many of these animals in peril, that the regional director for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service sent a letter to your company complaining about the slow response. This was given to us yesterday by the service. You dispute this information?
We have responded to all of those communications that we've had, and during the same time, we had surplus capacity, about 50% of the Valdez capacity, that was surplus capacity for handling otters. There has not been a shortage of facilities to handle otters.
I can just tell you that the information given to us by people who have just returned from Seward and also from Congressman Vento is in direct contradiction of what you've just said. And I would just join my colleague, Mr. DeFazio, in the hope that before this day is ended, that Exxon can give us an adequate response to this question and some evidence as to which side is correct. And I would tell you that clearly there's a dispute at this moment.
Would the gentleman yield?
Happy to.
In your response, you just suggested that there is surplus capacity at the Valdez facility. That is not the issue, because the people who are treating the otters have suggested that they do not want to place additional stress on these otters by bringing them to Valdez. They want to treat them on site. That was an original controversy, if you'll remember back in the early days of the spill, about whether or not an effort should have been made to locate a site out further into the sound and not bring the otters all the way back here. Okay? So it's the same controversy now, and the same people who work with these animals are telling us that you ought not to bring them all the way back here because you have a pen there. You ought to bring the pen out there. That's the distinction. So we're not just, you know, we're not Motel 6 judging what our vacancy rate here is. We're trying to put assets where they're needed. And what the experts are telling us is the assets are needed in Seward. And you're saying, well, you can't have them because you got a vacancy rate in Valdez.
That's not what we're saying.
That's what
Mr.
you just
Chairman.
Told Mr. Durbin. You want it read back to you?
Let me clarify myself, if I may, Mr. Chairman. We are expanding the otter facility in Seward, and we have agreed to do that. We do have experts that are available to us that also advise that it is reasonable to transport otters. And we do have excess capacity here in Valdez. That has not prevented us from building a facility in Seward.
The point is that the Exxon experts will always rule. The Exxon experts will rule on otters, they'll rule on dispersants, they'll rule on skimming, they'll rule on contingency plans. That's my concern. Those who perpetrated the crime define the restitution. And that cannot be allowed to happen. People who are somewhat in the middle here in terms of fish and wildlife and other individuals have suggested that it's other than that. But there's no question your company, with its assets and its worldwide resources, has experts on every conceivable subject. You're now putting your experts to work on the greatest oil spill in the continental United States.
Mr. Chairman.
And it's been a disaster, you and your experts.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Yes.
With respect to bird and otter centers, in terms of Exxon experts, if you will, we brought in recognized experts from California wildlife institutions.
I'm well aware of that.
These are not Exxon people. And if you have visited with the two here in Valdez, you know, as I do, that their principal concern is for the birds and the otters, which they're caring for. And they're not going to color their judgment or their actions or let us do otherwise.
The ones suggested to us as we visited the facility about the stress on the animals.
If I could reclaim my time.
You're out of time. No.
Let me try to move to another topic that I don't believe has been addressed. On April the 11th of this year, Admiral Yost of the U.S. Coast Guard testified before my subcommittee in Washington in reference to the Exxon Valdez incident. And at that time, he related the following information, that the captain of your tanker, Captain Hazelwood, when he renewed his license several months before this incident, had responded on an application question as to the whether he had ever been convicted for any offenses other than minor traffic offenses. He responded, "No, I have not." Admiral Yost went on to say, "A check of his record now shows that within the period that he covered in his application, he had had four convictions for driving while intoxicated, some of those resulting in fines, others resulting in suspension of his license. Immediately prior to the Exxon Valdez incident, what was the corporate policy of Exxon to determine whether or not the captains of your tankers were fit to serve?"
Let me speak to our drug and alcohol policy, both policy and practice, if I might. Back in the 70s, we put in place an alcohol policy. It's a very simple policy in respect of its impact on our employees while they're working or on our facilities. Throughout our operations, alcohol is prohibited in any form of substance, and an individual showing up to work while intoxicated is prohibited. That is against policy and is a dischargeable offense and has been administered that way since the 70s. In 1986, we began to work on a new policy, drug and alcohol policy now. It contained similar prohibitions. So if, in fact, the captain did or was consuming alcoholic beverage or was in any way intoxicated on the night that this happened, that's obviously against our policy and our practice. Now, with respect to driver's licenses, we do not routinely check, we do not check driver's licenses of employees. We had no knowledge, never, ever, any situation regarding the captain's driver's license. We looked to the Coast Guard, in this instance, for a valid master's license. That's what we require from our tanker captains.
Mr. Stevens, in the state of Illinois and in many states across the nation, a person who is convicted of driving under the influence loses their privilege to drive an automobile immediately for a period of at least 1 year. It is felt that this act of irresponsibility forfeits their right to get behind the wheel again. It strikes me that that is now becoming a national trend, and that most states use that same standard. And it would seem to me that it is remiss on the part of Exxon not to have recognized this fact and not to have realized, with all of your technical experts and corporate resources, that each of your employees, particularly those in the most sensitive positions, the captains of the oil tankers, should have signed a waiver of the right to check against their national driver registry records to determine their conviction rate. Had this been done, I think a very simple step, we might have averted this disaster completely. Can you explain to me why Exxon did not ask for such a waiver so that you could verify to your own satisfaction that you were holding your company to the highest possible standard when it came to the management of these oil tankers?
Congressman, I'm sure you appreciate the very gray dividing line between an individual's right to privacy and the right of an employer. I'll not get into that, but I will say this, that you make a very good point. There are many lessons to be learned from this accident, this tragedy. We're in the process of looking at the very point you raise, and I expect we'll be making some changes.
We've been told by the Coast Guard that on the Exxon Valdez tanker, the night of this spill, there was some breathalyzer equipment to check for intoxication. Is that standard equipment on your tankers?
There is no breathalyzer. What we have on board is a standard test kit, which will provide a urine sample and a blood sample. But we do not have breath analyzers.
Can you tell me why that's placed on board?
Yes, there's a Department of Transportation regulation which goes into effect in December of this year, which will require random testing. We have, for a number of years since 1984, have been conducting drug and alcohol tests using trained inspectors and dog search. And whenever they've gone aboard, they've carried the test kits. But since about the past 6 months we have, or maybe it's a year, we have put test kits on all of our vessels.
I might just say parenthetically that...
And by the way, it's our practice. In the event of any kind of incident, we require testing ourselves.
I might just say parenthetically that those of us who are in public office often take the criticism from the private sector that we harass, that we are imposing standards on private industry and businesses that are unnecessary, and in fact cause them to expend resources unnecessarily. Here we have testimony from you suggesting that as soon as the federal government started pushing in this area, your company started changing its standard, moving forward to meet that new standard.
Now, we have had, Congressman, a very aggressive program. Drug and alcohol searches we've had.
Well, let's talk about that aggressive program.
Yes,
did you have any supervisor the night of this incident in any way, shape, or form either meet with or examine Captain Hazelwood before he got on this tanker in Valdez?
No.
So your aggressive program,
yes,
it appears to me, was totally deficient when it came to determine whether the person who was responsible for this tanker was physically fit to be on the bridge that night and in charge of a tanker which has wreaked havoc on Prince William Sound. You had no procedure to determine whether or not that person was fit. Is that correct?
There is a check through the Alyeska security system in which all of our crewmen, including masters, are required to go through a check system in which they can observe the physical mannerisms of everybody going back to our ships.
So describe what that test is, please.
They are asked to walk through a maze as they go into the terminal facility.
And are they observed by some employee of Alyeska during that period?
No, they are contract security people who observe, and I believe there's two of them at the station. And if they observe any kind of abnormality in the behavior of the individual, they are instructed not to allow them on a ship.
It's observation, and they smell their breath, and they search if they're carrying anything.
Are records kept of that test?
Well, the test of the search and of the observation?
Yes.
I can't say we can find out for you and put it in the record.
That would be most helpful. Are you aware?
I'm told, incidentally, that one of the security people on duty this evening is a recovering alcoholic himself and is very capable of observation.
Can you tell me, Mr. Stevens or Mr. Rossi, in this particular evening, was Captain Hazelwood observed?
I believe the answer to that is yes, and I believe that the NTSB inspectors did, in fact, interviewers did, in fact, interview the guards there.
That's my
belief. I can't attest to it as absolutely correct.
Mr. Stevens?
One other individual outside of Exxon's employee involved, and of course that's the pilot that was on the vessel when the ship left port.
Was there an observation that Captain Hazelwood was intoxicated as he left the Valdez terminal the night of this incident?
Not to my knowledge, no sir.
I don't know the details on this. I don't know whether he was intoxicated or when he became intoxicated at the time of, or any relevant time that evening. But I would suggest to you that when we consider the gravity of the situation, Exxon's come to learn the hard way, and I think many in corporate America would agree that if we are going to give this type of responsibility to an individual, the tests have to go far beyond the observations of a contract employee and walking through a maze. I would hope that your company would show leadership in this area, and I can assure you if you do not, those of us at the federal level will try to help you. If I could move to another area, perhaps Mr. Harrison would like to comment on this. Can you tell me whether you heard the comments earlier by Admiral Robbins in terms of the resources necessary now to meet your September 15th deadline?
Yes, sir, I heard that.
Now, the Admiral, of course, qualified his remark by saying he was giving only an estimate, but he suggested that the resources presently available to the cleanup effort in Prince William Sound were about half of what is necessary to meet your own September 15th deadline. Do you agree with that?
It was the first time that I'd heard a public comment on that. We are waiting for the Admiral's response to the plan. We think we've turned out a plan that is environmentally and operationally sound, and we put it forth on that basis, sir.
If, in fact, Coast Guard should call for doubling the resources in the Sound now for the cleanup effort, is Exxon prepared to do that?
We have always been prepared to respond to what the Coast Guard is requiring.
That's a good answer, but let's go back to the question.
Sure.
Mr. Harrison, have you received a letter from the Regional Director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service about the Seward Otter Center?
We received a letter requesting the Otter Center. We did reply to the letter and agree to build the Otter Center. Yes, sir.
And I haven't seen this letter, but I've heard about it, and it was suggested that there was some dissatisfaction by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service concerning Exxon's response for the Seward Otter Center. Was that a fair characterization?
We did not ever receive a response. We responded, and we have received no response, written or verbal, to my knowledge, about that.
Well, it's certainly a little different scenario than we had described to us. In fact, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service told us that an otter rehab center was needed in Seward, that it was requested from your company in early April. But 2 weeks ago, your company signed off on a land lease, that you're now in the process of signing off on modular trailers, and that because this has taken so long and there are so many of these animals in peril, that the regional director for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service sent a letter to your company complaining about the slow response. This was given to us yesterday by the service. You dispute this information?
We have responded to all of those communications that we've had, and during the same time, we had surplus capacity, about 50% of the Valdez capacity, that was surplus capacity for handling otters. There has not been a shortage of facilities to handle otters.
I can just tell you that the information given to us by people who have just returned from Seward and also from Congressman Vento is in direct contradiction of what you've just said. And I would just join my colleague, Mr. DeFazio, in the hope that before this day is ended, that Exxon can give us an adequate response to this question and some evidence as to which side is correct. And I would tell you that clearly there's a dispute at this moment.
Would the gentleman yield?
Happy to.
In your response, you just suggested that there is surplus capacity at the Valdez facility. That is not the issue, because the people who are treating the otters have suggested that they do not want to place additional stress on these otters by bringing them to Valdez. They want to treat them on site. That was an original controversy, if you'll remember, back in the early days of the spill, about whether or not an effort should have been made to locate a site out further into the Sound and not bring the otters all the way back here. Okay, so it's the same controversy now, and the same people who work with these animals are telling us that you ought not to bring them all the way back here because you have a pen there. You ought to bring the pen out there. That's the distinction. So we're not just, you know, we're not Motel 6 judging what our vacancy rate here is. We're trying to put assets where they're needed. And what the experts are telling us is the assets are needed in Seward. And you're saying, well, you can't have them because you got a vacancy rate in Valdez.
That's not what we're saying.
That's what you just told Mr. Durbin. You want it read back to you?
Let me clarify myself, if I may, Mr. Chairman. We are expanding the otter facility in Seward, and we have agreed to do that. We do have experts that are available to us that also advise that it is reasonable to transport otters. And we do have excess capacity here in Valdez. That has not prevented us from building a facility in Seward. We are expanding.
The point, I guess, is that the Exxon experts will always rule. The Exxon experts will rule on otters, they'll rule on dispersants, they'll rule on skimming, they'll rule on contingency plans. That's my concern. Those who perpetrated the crime define the restitution. And that cannot be allowed to happen. people who are somewhat in the middle here in terms of fish and wildlife and other individuals have suggested that it's other than that. But there's no question your company, with its assets and its worldwide resources, has experts on every conceivable subject. You're now putting your experts to work on the greatest oil spill in the continental United States.
Mr. Chairman.
And it's been a disaster, you and your experts.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Yes.
With respect to Bird and Otter Centers, in terms of Exxon experts, if you will, we brought in recognized experts from California Wildlife Institutions.
I'm well aware of that.
These are not Exxon people. And if you have visited with the two here in Valdez, you know, as I do, that their principal concern is for the birds and the otters, which they're caring for. And they're not going to color their judgment or their actions or let us do otherwise.
And the ones suggested to us as we visited the facility about the stress on the animals.
If I could reclaim my time.
You're out of time. No.
Let me try to move to another topic that I don't believe has been addressed. On April the 11th of this year, Admiral Yost of the U.S. Coast Guard testified before my subcommittee in Washington in reference to the Exxon Valdez incident. And at that time, he related the following information, that the captain of your tanker, Captain Hazelwood, when he renewed his license several months before this incident, had responded on an application question as to the whether he had ever been convicted for any offenses other than minor traffic offenses. He responded, "No, I have not." Admiral Yost went on to say, "A check of his record now shows that within the period that he covered in his application, he had had 4 convictions for driving while intoxicated, some of those resulting in fines, others resulting in suspension of his license. Immediately prior to the Exxon Valdez incident, what was the corporate policy of Exxon to determine whether or not the captains of your tankers were fit to serve?"
Let me speak to our drug and alcohol policy, both policy and practice, if I might. Back in the 70s, we put in place an alcohol policy. It's a very simple policy in respect of its impact on our employees while they're working or on our facilities. Throughout our operations, alcohol is prohibited in any form of substance, and an individual showing up to work while intoxicated is prohibited. As against policy and is a dischargeable offense and has been administered that way since the 70s. In 1986, we began to work on a new policy, drug and alcohol policy now. It contained similar prohibitions. So if, in fact, the captain did or was consuming alcoholic beverage or was in any way intoxicated on the night that this happened, that's obviously against our policy and our practice. Now, with respect to driver's licenses, we do not routinely check, we do not check driver's licenses of employees. We had no knowledge, never, ever, any situation regarding the captain's driver's license. We look to the Coast Guard, in this instance, for a valid master's license. That's what we require from our tanker captains.
Mr. Stevens, in the state of Illinois and in many states across the nation, a person who is convicted of driving under the influence loses their privilege to drive an automobile immediately for a period of at least 1 year. It is felt that this act of irresponsibility forfeits their right to get behind the wheel again. It strikes me that that is now becoming a national trend, and most states use that same standard. And it would seem to me that it is remiss on the part of Exxon not to have recognized this fact and not to have realized, with all of your technical experts and corporate resources, that each of your employees, particularly those in the most sensitive positions, the captains, the oil tankers, should have signed a waiver of the right to check against their national driver registry records to determine their conviction rate. Had this been done, I think a very simple step, we might have averted this disaster completely. Can you explain to me why Exxon did not ask for such a waiver so that you could verify to your own satisfaction that you were holding your company to the highest possible standard when it came to the management of these oil tankers?
Congressman, I'm sure you appreciate the very gray dividing line between an individual's right to privacy and the right of an employer. I'll not get into that, but I will say this. You make a very good point. There are many lessons to be learned from this accident, this tragedy. We're in the process of looking at the very point you raise, and I expect we'll be making some changes.
We've been told by the Coast Guard that on the Exxon Valdez tanker, the night of this spill, there was some breathalyzer equipment to check for intoxication. Is that standard equipment on your tankers?
There was no breathalyzer. What we have on board is a standard test kit, which will provide a urine sample and a blood sample. But we do not have breath analyzers.
Can you tell me why that's placed on board?
Yes, there's a Department of Transportation regulation which goes into effect in December of this year, which will require random testing. We have, for a number of years since 1984, have been conducting drug and alcohol tests using trained inspectors and dog search, and whenever they've gone aboard, they've carried the test kits. But since about the past 6 months, we have, or maybe it's a year, we have put test kits on all of our vessels.
I might just say parenthetically that...
And by the way, it's our practice, in the event of any kind of incident, we require testing ourselves.
I might just say parenthetically that those of us who are in public office often take the criticism from the private sector that we harass, that we are imposing standards on private industry and businesses that are unnecessary, and in fact cause them to expend resources unnecessarily. Here we have testimony from you suggesting that as soon as the federal government started pushing in this area, your company started changing its standard, moving forward to meet that new standard.
Now, we have had, Congressman, a very aggressive program, drug and alcohol searches we've had.
Well, let's talk about that aggressive program.
Yes,
did you have any supervisor the night of this incident in any way, shape, or form either meet with or examine Captain Hazelwood before he got on this tanker in Valdez?
No.
So your aggressive program, it appears to me, was totally deficient when it came to determining whether the person who was responsible for this tanker was physically fit to be on the bridge that night and in charge of a tanker which has wreaked havoc on Prince William Sound. You had no procedure to determine whether or not that person was fit. Is that correct?
There is a check through the Alyeska security system in which all of our crewmen, including masters, are required to go through a check system in which they can observe the physical mannerisms of everybody going back to our ships.
So describe what that test is, please.
They are asked to walk through a maze as they go into the terminal facility.
And are they observed by some employee of Alyeska during that period?
No, they are contract security people who observe, and I believe there's two of them at the station. And if they observe any kind of abnormality in the behavior of the individual, they are instructed not to allow them on a ship.
It's observation, and they smell their breath, and they search if they're carrying anything.
Are records kept of that test?
Well, the test of the search and of the observation?
Yes.
I can't say we can find out for you and put it in the record.
That would be most helpful. Are you aware?
I'm told, incidentally, that one of the security people on duty this evening is a recovering alcoholic himself and is very capable of observation.
Can you tell me, Mr. Stevens or Mr. Rossi, in this particular evening, was Captain Hazelwood observed?
I believe the answer to that is yes, and I believe that the NTSB inspectors did in fact, interviewers did in fact interview the guards there.
That's my
belief. I can't attest to it as absolutely correct.
Mr. Stevens?
One other individual outside of Exxon's employ involved. And of course, that's the pilot that was on the vessel when the ship left port.
Was there an observation that Captain Hazelwood was intoxicated as he left the Valdez terminal the night of this incident?
Not to my knowledge, no, sir.
I don't know the details on this. I don't know whether he was intoxicated or when he became intoxicated at the time of or any relevant time that evening. But I would suggest to you that when we consider the gravity of the situation, Exxon's come to learn the hard way, and I think many in corporate America would agree that if we are going to give this type of responsibility to an individual, the tests have to go far beyond the observation of a contract employee and walking through a maze. I would hope that your company would show leadership in this area, and I can assure you if you do not, those of us at the federal level will try to help you. If I could move to another area, perhaps Mr. Harrison would like to comment on this. Can you tell me whether you heard the comments earlier by Admiral Robbins in terms of the resources necessary now to meet your September 15th deadline?
Yes, sir, I heard that.
Now, the Admiral, of course, qualified his remark by saying he was giving only an estimate, but he suggested that the resources presently available to the cleanup effort in Prince William Sound were about half of what is necessary to meet your own September 15th deadline. Do you agree with that?
It was the first time that I'd heard a public comment on that. We are waiting for the Admiral's response to the plan. We think we've turned out a plan that is environmentally and operationally sound, and we put it forth on that basis, sir.
If, in fact, the Coast Guard should call for doubling the resources in the Sound now for the cleanup effort, is Exxon prepared to do that?
We have always been prepared to respond to what the Coast Guard is requiring.
That's a good answer, but let's go back to the question. If they call on you to double the resources necessary, the Coast Guard does, will Exxon, in fact, do that? Perhaps Mr. Stevens is a little closer to the pocketbook.
Well, that's not the concern. It's not a pocketbook question. It's a question of a resource question. We will comply within our ability to utilize the resources that are available. Yeah, you smile at my question answer, but let me just give you an example. For instance, we have virtually used up for what we are mobilizing at the point right now all of the 6-inch nipples that are available in North America. So we're having to manufacture those now. It's just a logistics problem that I'm qualifying it with.
I understand your logistics problem, and I also understand that as of May 5th, we've cleaned up less than 2 miles of shoreline, that by Exxon's own estimates, there are some 364 miles of shoreline that need to be cleaned. And your own deadline for at least making some sort of effort at this suggests it'll be done by September 15th. That's tough for those of us who've been out to Smith Island, where in fact there have been 2 cleanup efforts and the beaches you see it today still need some work, to believe that you can hit this September 15th deadline. Now, I understand the limitations when you can't buy equipment that just isn't available, but if in fact it's necessary for you to deploy more people, to bring in more vessels, and to actively engage yourself at greater expense, is it your testimony that Exxon's prepared to do that?
Of course, we haven't seen the response yet, but you know, we are going to do our best to clean up every bit of that beach.
I think that's probably the best answer I'm going to get from too. If Mr. Stevens, can you add anything to that? Perhaps Mr. Harrison is beyond his jurisdiction in committing these resources.
No, Mr. Harrison is in charge of this operation up here, and he has no constraints on any resources that he needs to do this job, other than safety, which has been referred to several times.
Could you tell me how much the Exxon Corporation has expended to date, roughly, on this cleanup effort?
I think the figure is just on the cleanup. Having nothing to do with the vessel itself. The current figure, I believe, I was in the range of $95 million.
As of May 5th, just below $95 million.
Has Exxon established any kind of limitation on the amount of money they're going to spend on this effort?
Congressman, in view of the very publicly visible commitment we've taken to deal with the problem, obviously to have done so or to do so would be counter to that. The answer is absolutely not. We said we're going to do the job, and that's what we're going to do.
Fine. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
To your knowledge, has Exxon lobbied anybody on the response that the Coast Guard
is that you're now awaiting? Have you talked to anybody in the Department of Transportation, the Secretary of Transportation?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Mr.
Well,
Chairman.
You have submitted a plan, and the question appears to be whether or not the Coast Guard will accept that or whether they will modify it. What I'm asking is, have you engaged in any other efforts within the Department of Transportation?
Or not with, to my knowledge.
With the Commandant
not to
or anybody
my knowledge
else?
At all. I have talked to Admiral Yost in the past week.
Island to head to I think Kenai or what have you when they're carrying royalty oil. You know, there's a lot of other scenarios here. Could have happened 3 weeks later, 4 weeks later. Could have happened in the middle of the sand. But what we're really left with is a failure. Is a real failure in terms of being able to respond. Some of it we'll say is bureaucratic between the Coast Guard, the state, and you on dispersants. The rest of it is equipment is not here, and how much can you dedicate to this operation, but you can't. I don't think you can look the American public in the eye and say, "Well, this was a skimming success," or this was.
Oh,
a,
I would agree with you totally.
It's really very, very this is really a horrible failure. I mean, isn't this essentially a real horrible failure?
It clearly showed us the limitations of current skimming equipment.
Well, let me ask you this, and you shouldn't have to speak for the whole industry, but. Between our committees, we have proposal after proposal to work in tougher environments than this one that may be more risky in terms of movement of oil and ships. And we cannot tell, and this isn't, I'm the last one to look for a risk-free environment, but we cannot tell people that when you get a major spill, when you breach one of these super tankers, that we can handle it. It's by guess and by God. And that's kind of where we are in terms of the matching of the technology to recover oil and to clean it up. We're way out ahead in terms of our ability to recover. And we're, you know.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Sure.
There are clearly some lessons to be learned from this tragedy. Congressman Durbin touched on one a moment ago. There have been several others referenced by the committee. You certainly touched on a major one here in your comments. Not only our own company, but the industry under the auspices of the American Petroleum Institute has a massive effort underway to go in and relook at oil spill contingency planning and all of the considerations related to it, including research and development in terms of the equipment and so on. We've got to not only look at our own operations, we've got to look collectively as an industry where we share potential spill exposure, and then also look at the technology and the organization, and that's what's being done.
You know, there's, and I think this is somewhat analogous, there are whole communities and regions of the country that have rejected nuclear power because they were not comfortable with an evacuation plan. And I think we're kind of at that juncture in your industry. If the public cannot be comfortable on the coast of California, the coast of South Carolina, or I guess some parts of Florida where drilling is looked at, or up here in Bristol Bay, in Prince William Sound, if they can't be comfortable that these spills can be responded to on a timely and effective basis, and that's just on that basis, I don't think that they're going to buy into the notion that we ought to expand the risk and expand the opportunities for failure. You know, somebody said it's one in every 241 years, or it's one in a million trips. It turned out to be one in 8,000 or something. I don't think people are going to roll the dice that way with the environment. And with you know, if this happened on the California coast, the environment would have been a task, but the economics may have been far greater than here. And I'm taking you at your word that that's a lesson that this industry, you're kind of a representative of the industry at this point. It's your spill, it's your problem, and everybody else is watching. That unless some dramatic change takes place, I'm not going to bet 1950 cleanup technology on 1990 exploration. I just cannot do that for my constituents and for the constituents of areas that have to run the risk. But that's kind of where we are. I mean, we're kind of picking this stuff up in old World War II landing crafts the best we can. And we've just had a world-class demonstration of a dramatic failure to match the cleanup resources with the disaster. And I don't do that to point a finger at you. Nobody could have matched those, apparently, because you've assembled almost everything that's available in the world, and one of your competitors would have had the same problem. But I think it says something about the state of the industry, where we're either going to get more deeply involved in your business through the Coast Guard and other agencies, or you're going to come up with a model plan that inspires a great deal of more confidence and credibility than this contingency plan, or, you know, this country's going to have some very tough, difficult decisions to make. And after this episode, I think we all see where the public opinion is about those decisions. And I recognize it's 25% of the oil and the possibilities for more and all of that. Taking all of that into the equation, I think we're at the point where we are with Shoreham, where people said, if you can't guarantee the safety of this population, we don't want to participate.
Mr. Chairman, of course, you frame your comments in the context of exploration and development. The alternative to meet the oil supply, oil demand of this country is to import more oil. And as you know, that imported oil
moves
through tankers.
That's not the only alternative. That's clearly not the only alternative.
Whatever the demand is for oil, though, we either produce it domestically or we import it. Now, I realize that there are other energy forms and there's also energy conservation. Nevertheless, I think if you look to the future, we are going to need substantial volumes of oil for as long as we can see, as long as you and I are going to be around.
I'll grant you that.
And we either import it or we produce domestically.
I grant you that, and but we just, need saying that, just saying that does not relieve you as an industry of the obligation
to provide it
in the safest manner that we possibly can.
I accept that fully, whether it's exploration and development or whether it is importation of oil. And I've already commented on what we as a company and the industry is doing.
Ms. Durbin?
I want to return to a topic that's been touched on several times here, but I think there's some information here which I'd like to share with this committee, and I'd like a response from the panel. I have in my hand a copy of a letter that was sent on May 1st, 1989 to Mr. Don Cornett, Alaska Coordinator, Exxon Company USA. Are any members of the panel here familiar with Mr. Cornett?
Yes.
Are you, Mr. Harrison?
Yes.
Are you in communication with Mr. Cornett on a regular basis?
Yes, sir.
How frequently?
Generally daily.
Generally.
On May 1st, 1989, this letter was sent by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to Mr. Cornett, certified mail, return receipt requested. Do you have a copy of that letter with you?
I don't have a copy of that with me, but I do have a copy of our answer to that letter.
Well, I can tell you what was included in this letter suggests that the testimony given to us earlier about this otter rehabilitation facility in Seward is not accurate. Let me just tell you that according to this letter, Exxon has been promising since April the 7th to establish this rehabilitation center for otters in Seward. Several times they've been called on and asked why they haven't done so, and have promised again without results. And I'll now quote directly from this letter signed by Mr. Walter Steiglitz, Regional Director, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, quote, "This unconscionable lack of responsiveness by Exxon in completing the otter rehabilitation facility in Seward, coupled with shallow excuses for delay, is totally unacceptable." I won't go into all of the details. That sums it up pretty well. But he suggested that you have now forced the transportation of these otters from the Seward area into Valdez. Apparently, at least one otter has died because of the additional stress of transport or delay in the treatment. Other unnecessary deaths will occur. He concludes by saying, "I demand that you personally take whatever action is necessary without further delay." Mr. Harrison, when we asked this question earlier, you said this was taken care of. Now, has it happened since May 1st?
Congressman, I have a letter that I'll be glad to put in for the record that we responded on May 1st to that letter. And I'll read one paragraph from that response, but I'll be glad to enter the entire letter.
Well, you'll be allowed to do that, I'm sure, with the...
Not objection.
permission.
As of May the 2nd, 1989, the Seward Otter Facility will be able to handle a limited number of otters with full operational plan for May the 3rd or 4th. At that time, the 8 otters being currently handled at the Seward Bird Facility will be transferred to the completed otter facility. By any test of reason, moving from a completed lease to an operational facility in this time frame represents a high, sincere, and competent level of response on our part. But I'm glad to enter the entire letter.
I'm happy to have the letter in the record. I can tell you that the first promise apparently was made April the 7th when Mr. Cornett, Mr. Al Mackey, M-A-K-I, and Mr.
Dr. Mackey.
Yeah. Mackey and Mr. Pete Leathard were involved in separate telephone conversations with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife. At that time, they were promised the facility would be in place 4 or 5 days later.
We will be glad. All of those issues are addressed in this response, and I'm glad to provide it.
I'm glad to have the letter. I'll be happy to enter this one. More importantly, we want the facility up and running. And I would hope before 24 hours have passed that the folks who have been following this closely will be able to report to this committee that they are satisfied that that is the case. If it is not, we will return to this issue until it is. I think it's a matter of utmost importance. Those of us who've seen the otter rescue facility here in Valdez, I think we're struck by the pride which Exxon is rightly taking in bringing in some of the best professionals. I think President Stevens has alluded to that earlier. Dr. Terry Williams, for example, came in and spoke to us and showed us what was taking place there. That's pretty close to where a lot of people are keeping an eye on Exxon's activities. When it comes to Seward, it's a little more remote, and I sincerely hope that we are going to have the quick response promised.
We share your desires in this area, Mr. Congressman.
I'd like to deal briefly with three issues that still are outstanding in my view and which deal with Exxon's credibility.